and even common heart disease is now associated with vitamin D deficiency. We've always recognized vitamin D deficiency as a sunshine vitamin. So whether you're an amphibian, reptile, avian species, lower primate, our hunter-gatherer forefathers always appreciated the beneficial effects of the sun. In fact, early in life, our skin pigment evolved and devolved in order to make enough vitamin D. It was two physicians in New York City in 1921 realized that exposure to sunlight could cure rickets. This led then the U.S. government in 1931 to set up an agency to provide parents with recommendation for sensible sun exposure for your children. But in this day and age, for over 40 years, unchallenged has been the dermatology community recommending you should never be exposed to direct sunlight. In fact, poor parents don't know what to do if you put your kid outside without a sunscreen. You'd wind up in America's Most Wanted for child abuse. In fact, vitamin D is essential for bone health. And I thought I'd bring you some unusual cases that you might not have seen in your own practice. Here's a 7-month-old female, muscle weakness, tetanic seizures, 4.2 milligram percent calcium. This infant's about to die. And it turns out that this is Kermani, a lowland gorilla, first born in captivity at the Franklin Zoo in Boston. And she has severe hypocalcemia. And she's complaining to mom because her bones are hurting. And indeed, the dad's getting quite upset because he knows his daughter's in deep trouble. Indeed, the mom finally suggested they call me, which is what they did. And when I saw this infant, the infant had widened epiphyseal plates consistent with rickets. So what do you do when you have rickets? You aggressively treat. And what we gave this infant was 5,000 units of vitamin D a day. And the infant's feeling great. Indeed, I was the guest of honor for her first birthday. What's the message? The message is clear. During the first year of life, vitamin D deficiency will most definitely cause growth retardation and may put these infants at high risk of severe chronic diseases later in life. In 1989 in Boston, rickets was a major health problem. You can't believe in this day and age that it would be a problem as well, but indeed it is. And in fact, we see at our hospital over a dozen cases a year. And as you'll be hearing from Dr. Taylor and Bruce Hollis, we've now recognized that human milk essentially contains no vitamin D. It is inadequate to satisfy the infant's requirement. And as a result, we did a study at Boston Medical Center and looked at D deficiency in pregnant women who were on a prenatal vitamin. And we reported in 40 mother-infant pairs at birth, looking at 25-hydroxy-D, and 70% taking a multivitamin, 2.3 glasses of milk a day. Look at this, 76% of moms, 81% of newborns at the time of birth, vitamin D deficient. Also, recently it was reported by Bodner that preeclampsia seems to be associated with vitamin D deficiency. And as you will hear this on Tuesday at this poster session, is that Ann Merriwood has now found that C-sectioning is more probable in women that are vitamin D deficient. Now, I don't know if you're aware of the Jurassic syndrome. 750,000 young in the United States at risk every year. And here's a classic case of 1-year-old female, muscle weakness, bony deformities, and failure to thrive. Well, lettuce and crickets are not a healthy diet. And it's not because of people eating crickets. It's because of iguanas. Because of Jurassic Park, kids wanted to have a pet dinosaur. What better animal to have than a pet iguana? Iguanas are like human beings. They're vertebrates. They need a source of calcium and vitamin D. But 750,000 are reported in the United States every year, and they wind up on a steady diet of lettuce, which has no calcium or vitamin D. They have osteoporosis and osteomalacia. They fracture their rib cages, long bones. They fall off their perches, and they die. Well, my 9-year-old daughter went to see Jurassic Park with me. And I know if you keep up with the literature, you're well aware. Here, Ozzy, are you keeping up with the literature? Is Reptile Magazine, metabolic bone disease, this is what happens when you're vitamin D deficient. Now, I like the response of the audience, because you show a patient like this with D deficiency, nobody cares. But you show this, this gets their attention. And you have long bone fractures. Rickets and osteomalacia, how do you treat it? Well, you have to give the patient calcium. Well, just like with our patients, it's difficult to get them to take calcium. So how are you going to get this dumb animal to take some calcium? Well, this is Ramsey, not foaming at the mouth, but I have put in low-fat cream cheese in between the lettuce. It's getting all the calcium it needs. Okay, but there's no vitamin D in low-fat cream cheese. They love to be out in the sun because they make lots of vitamin D. Well, it turns out that industry rose to the occasion because for $40, you can buy Reptisun that mimics sunlight so that your pet reptile at home can make vitamin D in its skin. We don't do this for our nursing home residents, no, 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 but we will do this for our pet iguanas. right? So I have a very happy daughter with a very happy iguana. And hopefully convincing you need calcium and vitamin D for strong bones and healthy teeth. And when you do that, both my daughter and her iguana grew very well. And I am an usual consultant because I consult for most zoos in the United States. It's rare in foods. If you like cod liver oil, the kids used to line up in the 40s and 50s because it tasted so good. Right? We don't do this anymore. Right? You think about fish. You're always taught, eat lots of fish. Well, how much do you have to eat? That's not a pretty sight. It turns out that it's oily fish. There's about 500 to 1,000 units in a serving. So if you eat it every day, you may be getting enough. What about milk? You say you drink milk. Well, it turns out there's 100 units in a glass of milk. What about orange juice? Orange juice fortified with vitamin D, 100 units of vitamin D. This is where you get most of your vitamin D from. It's from casual and not so casual exposure to sunlight. Provides most of us with our vitamin D requirement. You're out there feeling great, making lots of vitamin D. What about in the wintertime? Well, I got one of my students to go on a roof of our institution in the middle of the month on a cloudless day to measure how much you're making. Long story short, spring, summer, and fall, you make lots of vitamin D. In the wintertime in Boston, you can't make any at all. When Ozzie saw this data, she wasn't convinced with all the test tubes up on the roof. We need evidence-based medicine. Well, I went to my students. I said, I need a volunteer. After a lot of hemming and hawing, I finally got one. I can assure you, Ozzie, you can't make any vitamin D in the wintertime in Boston. But, right, but what if you go, what latitude do you think you can't make any vitamin D in your skin? It's above Atlanta, Georgia. You essentially can't make any vitamin D in your skin. This is what we've been taught about the sun, that any exposure to sunlight is significantly damaging to your skin. So there's evolution thinking about our beach wear. We always wear sunscreen. If you put an SPF of 15 on, it reduces your ability to make vitamin D in your skin by 99%. So 90 to 95% of your vitamin D comes from exposure to sunlight. How much do you need? You never want to burn, can't look like this. And of course, coming from New England, you can't look like that. But we did a study in our students and gave them an oral dose of vitamin D to look at the equivalency. And one minimal erythema dose, a light pinkness to your skin in a bathing suit, is equivalent to taking 20,000 units of vitamin D. So your skin has a huge capacity to make it. Does it provide you with your vitamin D? You better believe it. All children have benefited from exposure to sunlight. Their highest blood levels are found in the summertime. So I typically recommend 5 to 15 minutes of arms and legs 2 to 3 times a week. Go out there, enjoy yourself, then put the sunscreen on. Take advantage of the beneficial effect, prevent the damaging effects due to excessive exposure. What about tigers? They're making a lot of vitamin D. It certainly makes a lot of money. It turns out that African Americans are at very high risk because their skin pigment is like an SPF of 15. It reduces their ability to make vitamin D in their skin by 95 to 99%. And that's why 30 to 50% of African Americans in the United States are vitamin D deficient. The data are clear. It's often misdiagnosed by docs because docs get a chem scan. If the calcium is normal, they're not thinking about D deficiency. But what you need to think about is 25-hydroxy vitamin D. Don't ever order the active form of vitamin D. It tells you nothing about vitamin D status. Normal range, we now know that this normal range is inadequate. Indeed, lifeguards typically have blood levels of over 100, like the Baywatch babes. Now, are they vitamin D intoxicated? No. Do they intoxicate men? Probably sometimes yes. You have to be detoxicated when you're above 150 nanograms per ml. What about that low level, which is what we really care about? Bob Heaney and others have shown us to maximize intestinal calcium absorption, you have to be above 32 nanograms per ml. And that's why most experts now recommend that you should be at least 30 nanograms per ml, and up to 100 is perfectly fine. So, NHANES 3 data set. If you look at white, African-American, and Mexican-Americans with only diet or even with supplement, they're nowhere near what now the National Osteoporosis Foundation is recommending of 800 to 1,000 units a day. Adequate intakes, don't even think about it. All of us now agree, most experts, you need 1,000 units of vitamin D a day, whether you're a child or an adult. Is it a problem? It's incomprehensible in this day and age. Well, we showed in Boston that 30% white, 42% Hispanic, and 84% African Americans at the end of the summer, vitamin D deficient. Here in Baltimore, 54% of community dwellers, vitamin D deficient. Unrecognized epidemic in adults over the age of 50. What about young adults? CDC reported in African-American women at the end of the winter, 15 to 49 years of age, severe D deficiency. We did a study of medical students and residents. Many of you in your audience never see the light of day, right? 32% D deficient, even though they were taking a multivitamin a day. Young white girls in Bangor, Maine, with Sue Sullivan and Cliff Rosen, we found 48% D deficient at the end of the winter. They go to summer camp, but they're wearing sunscreen all the time. 17% remain vitamin D deficient. Catherine Gordon reported that 52% of African American and Hispanic adolescent boys and girls vitamin D deficient throughout the year. Osteoporosis is a silent disease. Vitamin D deficiency, though, causes this other bone disease, osteomalacia. And osteomalacia is not a silent disease. In fact, typically, generalized bone pain, isolated bone pain, and muscle aches and pains are associated. In fact, this is often a diagnosis these patients get. In my experience, 40 to 60% are suffering from vitamin D deficiency. Here, in children and adults presenting to an emergency room with bone, muscle aches, and pains in Minnesota, Plotnikoff reported 93% vitamin D deficient. Higher your 25-hydroxy vitamin D, better is your lower extremity function. We know kids with rickets had muscle weakness. We also know Superman got probably most of his vitamin D from our strong sun because his muscle strength was due to the vitamin D receptor in his skeletal muscle. Indeed, we all now recognize vitamin D is critically important for muscle strength, decreases risk of falling, decreases risk of fracture in elders. Also, there's a positive association with your vitamin D status and your bone mineral density, no matter what race. We also know that to treat it, you don't take multivitamins, because if you take too many, A, you'll choke on these things, and B, you're going to get too much vitamin A. When you go to the gas station, do you get a gallon of gas? Well, you might now because it costs so much, but in the past, when the tank is on empty, you fill it up. Your vitamin D tank is on empty, you got to fill it. I typically recommend 50,000 units once a week for 8 weeks, followed by this nice little green pill every other week forever. 50,000 units twice a month works. Now, you've all heard this, right? And that is, vitamin D2 is only 30% as effective as vitamin D3. And it's based on a study where they gave 4,000 units for 2 weeks in ethanol, and there was a 50% difference in the 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels. Well, it turns out that R2-D2 was a little unhappy to hear about this because he didn't think he was any different than C-3PO. And in fact, who do you go to when you want to bust this myth? Well, we went to the Mythbusters, and we did a study. We gave 1,000 units of vitamin D2, 1,000 units of vitamin D3, or 500 units of vitamin D2 plus 500 units of vitamin D3 in adults at the end of the winter. Look at this. Placebo, 25-hydroxy D3 and D2, no difference, right? But we've also heard D2 destroys D3. You shouldn't be taking vitamin D2. So we did a study, and look at this. 25-hydroxy D3 levels don't change. In fact, I believe D3 and D2 are equal, and I think this is a busted myth. All right, but one thing I've learned when I give these talks is when I say 50,000 units of vitamin D, what docs remember more from medical school than anything else, don't ever make your patient vitamin D intoxicated. They've never seen vitamin D intoxication. They don't even know what vitamin D intoxication is, but they know 50,000 units are going to cause vitamin D intoxication. The data are clear on this. Again, here, VEETH showed 10,000 units a day for 5 months, no effect. All studies show you can take up to 10,000 units a day without causing vitamin D intoxication. So I don't know what Hillary is thinking about, but this is what she's been telling people about. Vitamin D intoxication is very difficult to come by. So, who's at risk? Hopefully I've convinced you that everyone is. There's a small group out there, like I said, unlike dermatologists, that say why you should care. Because we were born, we evolved in sunlight. In fact, once you make vitamin D in your skin, it has to get activated in your kidneys. And it turns out that every tissue and cell in your body has a vitamin D receptor. Well, you have to ask the question, why? So what about the vitamin D and cancer connection? If you live at a higher latitude, you're at higher risk of colorectal cancer. The data are clear, 50% projected reduction if you're on 1,000 units of vitamin D a day. Colorectal cancer risk is reduced by as much as 50% if you have a 25-hydroxy D of at least 20 nanograms per ml. We also know breast cancer is associated with vitamin D deficiency and 50% lower risk with a 25-hydroxy D of 48 nanograms per ml. Colorectal cancer and Women's Health Initiative, right, doesn't really work, right? These are the data set, no effect. But what they didn't appreciate was that most of those women were vitamin D deficient. Follow them for 8 years, they had a 253% increased risk of developing colorectal cancer. Also, LAPI recently reported in over 1,200 women getting 1,100 units of vitamin D a day reduced risk of cancer by 60%. Prostate cancer, same observation's been made. Possible connection? We now know that most tissues and cells in your body activate vitamin D locally and regulate up to 200 different genes. We also know that it affects the immune system, and it's been known forever that macrophages activate vitamin D, but we've never understood why. We also knew that vitamin D protects you against TB, and now we know why, because when you activate a macrophage to make 125D, it tells the macrophage to produce cathelicidin, which kills infective agents. And this is why we think African Americans are at much higher risk of developing TB and having more aggressive disease. 125-dihydroxyvitamin D locally produced is important for regulating innate immunity. Vitamin D deficiency in diabetes. Studies done in Finland, with children getting at first year of birth, for the first year of life, 2,000 units a day, reduced their risk of getting type 1 diabetes by 78% after 31 years. If they had rickets, they had a 2.4-fold increased risk. And so, what is the evidence? We know that beta-ISLs have receptors. 125D stimulates insulin production, and there's good evidence it's associated with metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes. We also know that if you increase your calcium and vitamin D intake, relative risk of developing type 2 diabetes is reduced by 33%. So, also, if you take more vitamin D, you're less likely to die. Right? Increase at latitude, you are at increased risk of developing MS. We know that women taking more than 400 units a day reduce risk by 41%. Rheumatoid arthritis, same observation. Vitamin D deficiency is a disease of neglect. There's a mountain of evidence to suggest it's important for prevention of chronic diseases. Don't think about a normal level. Think about a healthy level, 30 nanograms per ml. How much do you need? Well, 100 units raises it 1 nanogram per ml, right? So if you're in this range, which is where all of you are, you need at least 1,000 units of vitamin D a day. So hopefully I've convinced you, you can't get it from your diet. It's from the sun. It's the major source, and we need to appreciate its benefits. Are you always working indoors wearing sunscreen all the time? What's your vitamin D status? You would be very surprised. What do I do? Well, what I do is I follow my own advice. I cycle and I take 1,000 units of vitamin D a day. And I've hopefully convinced you D deficiency is probably one of the most common medical conditions in the United States and, in fact, worldwide. We've recently published a New England Journal review in July of 2007 talking about all these benefits. You don't need to be a genius to know. You need more sensible sun and vitamin D supplementation recommendations. And I thank you for your kind attention.
Just Dr. Hollick, man. our patients are below the federal poverty level, and another 30% are below 200% of poverty. Our top 10 diagnoses are standard for community health centers, though vitamin D is at the top of our list. Wasn't there in 2006, but we found since we've been measuring vitamin D levels that over 80% of our patients are vitamin D deficient, and that makes it the most prevalent diagnosis in our community. Our health priorities are to increase access to health care, decrease health disparities, including infant mortality, and we participate in community-based participatory research, including in diabetes. What is a health disparity? The official definition was first, the first official definition occurred in September 1999 in response to a White House initiative. The National Institutes of Health convened a working group, and they defined health disparities as the differences in the incidence, prevalence, mortality, and burden of diseases and other adverse conditions in diverse health communities. This language comes from the CDC Office of Minority Health website, which states that current information about the biological and genetic characteristics of minority populations does not explain the health disparities experienced. And this shows the incidence of the life expectancy between the black and white populations, and shows that even though life expectancy has been increasing, the disparities between black and white populations has not changed significantly. Healthy People 2010 focuses on infant mortality, cancer screening and management, cardiovascular disease and diabetes, HIV and AIDS, and immunizations as a way of addressing health disparities. What are optimal levels of vitamin D for health? Dr. Hollick went through that, but let me just point out that he went to the Rift Valley in eastern Africa, where human beings originated, and found that the vitamin D levels in the population there were from 40 to 80 nanograms per ml, and also point out that the risk of colon cancer, fracture risk, low extremity function, and dental attachment all continue to improve even beyond 48 nanograms per ml. Vitamin D is produced from the skin, as Dr. Hollick went through, factors which inhibit that transmission of the ultraviolet B rays include latitude and season by their effect on the angle of traversal of the sun's rays, climatic conditions, land conditions, including building density, so that if you live in the canyons of New York, you're not going to get much sun. Altitude, clothing use, smog and air pollution, and skin factors such as pigmentation, photosensitivity, use of sunscreen. Dr. Hollick mentioned the importance of melanin. So health disparities in the populations, this shows the average white, Hispanic, and black populations. Vitamin D levels is taken from the NHANES study and show that as we measure it now, the average white person is sufficient, barely sufficient in vitamin D levels. Hispanic are insufficient, and the average black person is insufficient. And these are levels, over 200 patients, vitamin D levels taken from Mattapan Community Health Center and entered in our database. The linear regression line shows that through much of the year, our patients are deficient in vitamin D. This shows infant mortality and its relation to vitamin D, and shows the infant mortality in the white, in the various populations. And parses out the neonatal mortality and post-neonatal mortality, showing the superior contribution of neonatal mortality to overall infant mortality. And it also shows the inverse relationship to vitamin D levels. The CDC says that short gestation and low birth weight, along with congenital malformations, are the leading causes of death in the neonatal period, and that infants born premature or of low birth weight are more likely to die from SIDS. Here we're looking at infant mortality in low birth weight babies, and we see the overall low birth weight babies is increasing the black population, and especially very low birth weight with babies born below 750 grams. We also see that the incidence of total mortality related to babies born below 750 grams approaches two-thirds. Two-thirds of infant mortality occurs. This shows the inverse relationship of vitamin D levels to gestation. The rate of very premature babies on the left at 28 weeks of gestation, and the number of overall prematurity on the right. And the lower left chart shows the direct relationship of babies born who are over 8 pounds compared to the vitamin D levels in the populations. Dr. Hollick presented shows mean blood levels in the women of childbearing age, white population compared to black population. And by contrast, the blood levels of 14 patients at prenatal registration at Mattapan Community Health Center, showing that these mothers were very vitamin D deficient. Many studies have shown that the fetal cord blood contains only half the vitamin D levels of maternal cord blood, and that the vitamin D status of the fetus and neonate are totally dependent on the vitamin D stores of the mother. This shows some of the relationship between vitamin E intake and birth weight. A study that was done in Canadian Medical Association Journal in April 2005 correlated the increase of 40 units of vitamin D intake associated with a birth weight increase of 11 grams. And by extrapolation, 2,000 units a day would increase birth weight by 1.2 pounds. The cancer incidence and mortality in the United States and healthy people 2010's target is to reduce cancer death rate by 21%. Here we have breast incidence and mortality, and direct your attention to the lower right hand. In Mauritius, which is in West Africa at the western end of the Sahara, just above Senegal, very dark-skinned people had much less breast mortality rate than any of the populations in the United States and in Northern Europe. This compared lowest and highest quartiles of various aspects of vitamin D acquisition among various age groups, and shows that the highest quartile of vitamin D intake was associated with lower breast cancer risk. Here we have U.S. Colorectal cancer and lung cancer incidence and mortality, and here a study that showed, looking at the various quintiles, that the higher the vitamin D level, the lower the incidence of colorectal cancer and this is looking at 447 patients with early stage non-small cell lung cancer and showing overall survival between the lowest quartile and the highest quartile. Certainly is lower with vitamin D levels and for the more advanced stage 1B to 2B, a 45% the mortality in the highest quartile is 45% compared to the lowest quartile. And this is the study by Lapp that Dr. Hollick referred to. And it showed in that years 2 to 4 during the study that the relative incidence of cancers was only 23% in the population who received the vitamin D and calcium arm to the placebo. On prostate cancer mortality, and I point out in the upper left, right-hand corner, once again in Mauritius, very dark-skinned people, and the incidence of prostate cancer compared to Europe and populations in the United States. Okay, cardiovascular risk factors have been associated with vitamin D insufficiency, including diabetes, hypertension, congestive heart failure, obesity, and metabolic syndrome. These are average serum vitamin D levels in patients who are normotensive, prehypertensive, and hypertensive in a similar pattern in relation to basal metabolic index. And the right-hand slide shows the differences in quartiles shows the relative risk of hypertension between those who are less than 15 nanograms per ml and those that, who are higher than 30 nanograms per ml, and a similar relationship, though less pronounced, in the nurses' health study, which is predominantly women. Animal studies have shown insulin release from the pancreas is less in vitamin D deficient animals, that insulin sensitivity is directly correlated with vitamin D levels, and that low vitamin D is associated with high parathyroid hormone, which in turn is associated with increased insulin resistance and diabetes, and that parathyroidectomy has improved glucose intolerance in those patients. And this shows the serum levels for normal glycemic, pre-diabetic, and diabetic patients. And diabetes is taken from the NHANES study. Okay, and so we would expect, and Dr. Hollick alluded to this, the study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in September of this year searched the literature up through 2006 without any language restriction, multiple databases. 18 randomized controlled trials were identified in which vitamin D was given for any condition and death was an outcome that was reported. There were almost 60,000 participants, so almost 5,000 deaths. The mean trial period was a little less than 6 years, and the mean vitamin D dose, 500 units. And what it showed, as Dr. Hollick noted, was mortality rate 7% less than control, but in those who in those trials that lasted at least 3 years, the vitamin D subjects had 8% less mortality, and in those in which vitamin D was the only supplement additive given, there was a 9% less mortality. What we're showing here is a population related to dosing. The above slide shows patients who were treatment naive, and the below slide shows patients at Mattapan Community Health Center who received 50,000 units of vitamin D2 per week for 3 to 6 months. That's over 7,000 units a day. And what that graph shows is that many of the patients did not even receive achieve vitamin D deficiency at that level. Sufficiency at that level. Graph showing 86, the bar showing 86 level of vitamin D2 was a frail, little old woman who was approximately 89 years old, whose daughter was compulsive about giving her medicine regularly, and she got up to a level of 86 nanograms on 50,000 units a week for 6 months. She was on vitamin D for 6 months at that time. And just want to state that from our experience, reassessment of blood levels of vitamin D in the treatment of vitamin D deficiency is important because there's a wide range of variation of response. So that ends my presentation, and I hope that I've convinced you that there's a definite relationship between vitamin D deficiency and health disparities.
Thank you very much, Dr. Beeble. Dr. Taylor is next, and she's an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the Medical University of South Carolina and the Darby Children's Research Institute. She earned her medical degree from the University of Miami School of Medicine and currently studies infant vitamin D health. Dr. Taylor is currently funded by NIH to identify the vitamin D status that optimally supports preterm infant bone health. Dr. Taylor will tell us about vitamin D requirements in pregnancy and lactation.
Good mentioned, my name is Sarah Taylor. I'm from the Medical University of South Carolina, where we are currently conducting trials evaluating the vitamin D requirements in pregnancy and lactation for both mothers and infants. In pregnancy, the fetus is completely dependent on maternal supply of vitamin D. The American Academy of Pediatrics in Lactation recommends exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months of life and continuation for at least the first year of life. This breast milk that these infants who are exclusively breastfed are receiving is very, very low in vitamin D, as Dr. Hollick mentioned. 40 to 70 international units per liter is about as high as you can get with the current maternal supplementation of vitamin D. In addition, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no sun exposure for infants less than 6 months of age. So really, the only way for these babies to get any vitamin D is with oral supplementation. Well, here you have a mother who has chosen to exclusively breastfeed. She's chosen to provide her child with complete nutrition and to avoid ingestion of foreign substances, of preservatives, of carrier fluids and such. And we are now asking her to give an oral supplementation every day to her child. And it can be psychologically affect the mother also. Here, she would love to be able to provide complete nutrition to her infant, but with the current vitamin D supplementations of mom, she's unable to do that. Getting back to pregnancy for just a moment, vitamin D deficiency in pregnancy is associated with preeclampsia. Maternal vitamin D status has a positive correlation with infant head circumference at 6 and 9 months of life, and also a positive association with infant birth weight. Improvement continues through childhood. Maternal vitamin D status is associated with improved bone mineral content and bone mass at 9 years of age. There's a relationship of infant vitamin D status at birth with improved immune function, and the results can be long-lasting. Both multiple sclerosis and schizophrenia are associated with certain seasons of birth, and it is very possible that it's actually the low maternal vitamin D status during the winter, during a precise point in brain development, that may then lay the road for development of these diseases in the future. There is also consideration of a relationship with osteoporosis, that maternal vitamin D status can affect the development of osteoporosis later in life. In lactation, infant vitamin D intake has a positive association with bone mass at 9 years of age, with avoidance of type 1 diabetes mellitus, and with decreased severity of asthma. And then for the mom, we can't forget about the mom. Most of these diseases have already been covered, but I think this is important. You're talking about adult women. These mothers should be allowed to achieve vitamin D sufficiency despite being pregnant or breastfeeding an infant, and we need to be cognizant of their vitamin D needs also. So looking at our results, we are studying vitamin D supplementation in pregnancy. This is NIH-funded, and I believe in the abstract submitted, we had 277 moms enrolled. We now have 456 mothers. We measured a baseline circulating 25-hydroxy-D, which is the best indicator of nutritional status of vitamin D. We did this at 12 weeks gestation, which is just getting towards the end of the first trimester of pregnancy. This is in Charleston, South Carolina. We're at latitude 32. We're just at the border of that range where we have sunlight, the UVB sunlight exposure available year-round, where if you spend enough time in the sun, you can get the vitamin D you need. Now, in the winter, that can be lots and lots of hours, but it definitely is a different environment than the more northern latitudes of D.C. or Boston. And so these results were very surprising for living in this sunny environment. We defined vitamin D deficiency as less than 20 nanograms per ml, and 77% of our black mothers were vitamin D deficient. That means that they had already gone through that first trimester of pregnancy with vitamin D deficiency. 98% demonstrated vitamin D insufficiency, defined as less than 32 nanograms per ml. Equally surprising was the fact that we actually had 12% of our white mothers, so light pigmentation, they should have been able to get adequate vitamin D from the sun in our environment. 12% had vitamin D deficiency, 67% had vitamin D insufficiency, and the Hispanic mothers fell between these other two study groups. Getting on to lactation. We have had two pilot studies. We are currently in the middle of a multi-centered randomized controlled trial studying vitamin D supplementation in lactation. But I'll give a little background on our, and then go over the results of the two pilot studies. Current U.S. maternal recommendation is 200 international units per day of vitamin D. In prenatal vitamins, most prenatal vitamins do contain 400 international units per day vitamin D, but these doses are at the best going to give you 20 to 70 international units per liter. And an infant, by about a month, maybe getting towards 2 months of life, is taking about a liter of milk a day. So that gives you an idea, that shows you that's well below any requirements for the infants. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends 200 international units per day, and most U.S. formulas actually, by the time a baby's taking a liter of formula, are going to give at least 400 international units per day, maybe even more. And it really doesn't seem fair if the breastfeeding infants are actually getting less vitamin D than those infants who are receiving formula. So this was our first pilot study. We looked at these women for 3 months. 9 women were randomized to receive 400 international units per day of vitamin D3 and 1,600 international units per day of vitamin D2, and 9 received 400 of the D3 and 3,600 of the D2. And the reason we used the D2 is we really wanted to look at what our study supplementation was doing. Vitamin D3 is what your body makes when it's exposed to sun. It is what is in the prenatal vitamins, and actually that's what these women received to get the 400 was a prenatal vitamin. It's also what's in the milk and the juices and other things that are fortified. So by using the vitamin D2, we were really able to look at what we were giving the moms and that effect. Busy graph, and I'll go through it very quickly to get to the high points. If you look down at the bottom, first of all, this is the moms who are receiving 600 a day D2 and 400 a day D3. And this is mom circulating vitamin D and her 25-hydroxy-D status. If you look at the two lines on the bottom, that is maternal vitamin D. The purple is the D3. You can see that really maintained at baseline. At the vitamin D2, there was a small bump from the baseline of zero, but not much to be appreciated there. Then going on to the 25-hydroxy-D, the green is the total 25-hydroxy-D. We achieved a nice level within the sufficient range there, just above 35 nanograms per ml. But if you notice, most of this was due to the vitamin D2. I think those are mislabeled. That is actually vitamin D3 there in the brown that is actually going down, and vitamin D2 that is rising there. The vitamin D3 actually fell below the range of vitamin D deficiency, the 20 nanogram per ml mark. So if these moms had not been getting our supplementation, they actually would have fallen into vitamin D deficiency. And here, again, this is mislabeled. The vitamin D in the bottom is correct. The vitamin D3 there, there was just maintained at the baseline. Smaller rise in the vitamin D2. Total 25D did raise and was above 40 nanograms per ml. And again, like I mentioned, this is mislabeled. This was truly due to the vitamin D2 that they were receiving. And then looking at the milk that they were able to express, the vitamin D activity, which is also called anti-rachetic activity in the milk. The moms that were on the 2,000 units per day, they really were there. Their milk had the same vitamin D activity that the milk has when moms are on 200 and 400 international units per day, right there around 70 international units per liter. The moms that were getting 4,000 international units per day of vitamin D total, their milk achieved a mean of 140 international units per liter, so better, but still not adequate to provide vitamin D in mom's milk. And in the infants, you see here the vitamin D2 did rise slightly. There was just above 5 nanograms per ml. The vitamin D3 there in the green actually rose nicely, and since they weren't getting a lot of vitamin D3, this couldn't have really been coming from mom's milk, since the moms were only receiving 400 of vitamin D3. This was probably coming either from sun exposure, or more likely these babies were getting more formula than the moms were telling us, which is one nice thing we were able to look at by using the vitamin D2. And then also there in the total, though, did achieve a nice sufficient level in these babies. And then very similar results when using the 3,600 of D2 and the 400 of D3. Then we looked, did another pilot study looking at maternal versus infant vitamin D supplementation, and this was for 6 months. 10 women received 400 international units per day of vitamin D3, and their infants received 300, and then 9 women received 6,400 international units per day of vitamin D3, and the infants received placebo. And this is mom's serum 25-hydroxy-D status. The moms that received the 400, they actually were able, for the most part, to maintain vitamin D sufficient status. You see there is a drop there below 30 nanograms per ml that corresponded with winter months. But the, more importantly, the moms receiving 6,400 international units per day were not toxic. Their mean was just below 60 nanograms per ml, which was very exciting to show that they could take this amount of vitamin D without risk of toxicity to themselves. And then looking at their vitamin D, there was a nice rise in their, this is their vitamin D levels with the 6,400 international units, which is important because in breast milk you actually have both 25-hydroxy-D and the parent compound vitamin D expressed in the breast milk to give the vitamin D activity of the milk. And then this was the milk activity, and this is really what I wanted to show here. So with the moms receiving 6,400 international units per day of D3, we were able to achieve 843 international units per liter mean of vitamin D activity in the milk. So this was one of the first larger studies. There had been some case reports before of women who were receiving high vitamin D because of hypoparathyroidism. So this was the first time in normal healthy moms that we showed that you could give adequate vitamin D to mom, do it in a safe way, and be able to achieve higher amounts of vitamin D in her milk. And then in comparison, looking at how the infants did, the infants whose mothers were taking 6,400 international units nicely had the equivalent vitamin D status of the infants who were receiving the 300 international units per day, demonstrating that mom can supply a good amount of vitamin D activity in her milk by giving appropriate supplementation to mother. Safety, all of these mothers and infants had serum calcium concentrations that remained normal and no evidence of elevation of the calcium creatinine ratio. So in our pregnancy study, so far 82% of women began pregnancy with vitamin D insufficiency and 38% with vitamin D deficiency. In the lactation study, vitamin D supplementation of mother can provide adequate breast milk vitamin D to achieve vitamin D sufficiency in the nursing infant. And I also want to add, these are recent recommendations from the Canadian Pediatric Society, and this society should really be commended. They are really moving ahead to protect the mothers and infants in Canada from vitamin D deficiency. And this quote that I have here concerns protection of mom. Consideration should be given to administering 2,000 international units of vitamin D daily to pregnant and lactating women, especially during the winter months, to maintain vitamin D sufficiency. The effectiveness of this regimen and possible side effects should be checked with periodic assays for 25-hydroxy-D and calcium. And I think that this is a great start and hopefully will be continued of making real policy changes to support the vitamin D health of mothers and their infants. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're moving right along in spite of the technical difficulty. I want to now introduce Dr. Mona Calvo, who earned a PhD in nutritional sciences from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, which was followed by 5 years of postdoctoral training in the endocrine research unit of the Mayo Clinic in what she calls tropical Rochester, Minnesota. She has spent the last 20 years at the Center for Food Science and Applied Nutrition of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, working as both a research and review scientist. Dr. Calvo's current research interest focuses on safety and efficacy testing of new food sources for vitamin D, and she's particularly interested in knowing if these foods reduce risk of chronic kidney disease in both animal models and at-risk human populations. Dr. Calvo will give us evidence that will lead us to an answer by the end of her presentation, hopefully. Can the vitamin D needs of the North American public be met by current supplementation and fortification practices in the absences of sun exposure? Dr. Calvo, are we all set?
Maybe.
While we're getting that together, we'd ask you to please get your questions ready for the four panelists, and we will entertain them immediately following Dr. Calvo's presentation.
Thank you, Izzy. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'll try and summarize pretty much what everyone else has said who came before me. It's pretty hard to follow Dr. Hollick. And I'm specifically going to address issues of diet, so that might help clarify things. I first like to introduce my co-author, who represents the Canadian contingency, and we were really happy to see that last slide. In North America, we do diet factors together. That's Canada and the United States. And my co-author is Dr. Susan Whiting, who's studied nutritional sciences as I did at the University of Guelph in Canada, and she did an extensive postdoctoral studies at the University of British Columbia in renal physiology. For my talk, I'm asking a very specific question. Can the vitamin D needs of North America, the North American public, okay, the entire population, be met by current supplementation and fortification practices in both of these countries in the absence of sun exposure? Now, just to reiterate what's been said before me and illustrated quite well in many species by Dr. Hollick, sun exposure is the main source of circulating 25-hydroxyvitamin D. To take you through the pathway really quickly, using illustrations from highly recommended review by Dr. Hollick that was in JACE Journal of Clinical Investigation. Sun is needed to convert the precursor 7-dehydrocholesterol to vitamin D3, and that in turn is picked up, carried to the liver, and where its first metabolic step occurs and converts it to 25-hydroxy vitamin D. And that's why this is the main status indicator that we use to judge sufficiency. Now, when this isn't available, then we become reliant on the diet. And so dietary sources have to make up for this and contribute in this way. So there is a reliance on diet at certain times of the year. And in 1997, the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine formulated the dietary guidelines for all nutrients, really. Vitamin D and calcium were some of the first to come out. And they established what we call the adequate intake and the tolerable upper level. And I'll refer to the DRIs. Dietary recommended intakes, and I won't go through the numbers right here, but note that there are no provisions made for pregnancy, which I think is really amazing. It's the same as for an adult, for an adequate intake. And this is to sustain you when there's limited sunlight. There is a tolerable upper level was also established, and this is just the level beyond which safety cannot be guaranteed. But this is something we use in the regulatory world to govern the limits of what you can put into a dietary supplement. without getting the Food and Drug Administration after you. I'm remiss in stating at the beginning that I have no conflict of interest, and in the same light, I'm representing my own opinions and not those of the Food and Drug Administration. We use something on our label to give you a guideline for intake, because the label can't look back at you and say, oh, well, you're a 50-year-old person, you need this much. And so that value right there is what's commonly used is the DV, or the percent DV that you'll see on your nutrition panel. It's 10 micrograms or 400 IUs. So we did something right in that it's higher than the AI for most adults. I'm going to give you the conclusion right up front, so if we run over. For many Americans, poor vitamin D status that results from inadequate sun exposure cannot be optimized to the levels that you have seen that are associated with the prevention of disease by our current fortification practices or the levels in our dietary supplements in common use. And these follow the DRIs that I just showed you. When the DIRs were formulated, there was one risk factor for absence of sun exposure that was really reviewed, and that is what we refer to as vitamin D winter. There's insufficient solar radiation to produce the vitamin D3, and therefore you see, as you've seen in all the previous slides, a lowering of your 25-hydroxy vitamin D. Now, all that vitamin D winter really means is that it shows the effects of latitude and season. And Dr. Hollick presented the notion that it's really any city in North America that's above 35 degrees north latitude. So that includes Atlanta, even sunnier parts of California. And certainly the people who suffer the most are way up here in Canada. Edmonton is usually the furthest north that's quoted. These cities have vitamin D winters that last anywhere between 4 and 5 months. So for that duration of the year, you are dependent on diet. A significant risk factor that was not considered when the DRIs were formulated is that of skin pigmentation. Melanin effectively blocks solar radiation stimulus of synthesis of vitamin D in the skin. But this was not considered when the DRIs were formulated, largely due to lack of data. So what is the level that we really need to achieve in order to get this effect of reduced disease? And largely, I'm going to confuse you because I'm going to present them in SI units and nanomolars per liter. But most scientists now agree that it's between 75 and 80 nanomolar, or 35 of the nanograms per mil. I have to think in nanomolar, I'm sorry. And that's associated with a number of diseases. But again, we have limited data in this respect. So this is the level that we're shooting for. Now, is what we have in our current food supply, is it adequate to sustain these optimal, or not optimal, but sufficient levels of vitamin D during the winter? Now, this is a study taken from Reinhold Veith, in which he looked at women that were consuming the adequate intake, 0.5 to 5 micrograms versus 5 micrograms, and studied them over 2 seasons, in the winter and in the summer. And clearly, the 5 micrograms was not sufficient to bring them up to this 80 nanomolar level. This is just further evidence to show that. This is a study conducted in Germany, and in these individuals, again, 30 was the goal. This is in nanograms per liter and per mil. And they had two groups. One that where there was an intervention of 12.5 micrograms per day, and another where there was not. And clearly, you're able to sustain it, but this is more than that 5 microgram AI intake that I showed you earlier. The big question is, all of the previous studies that I've showed you and all the work to date in publication has been conducted in light-skinned Caucasians. No one has looked at the effect of pigmentation and how much more is required. Is this 12 to up to 50 micrograms per day? Possibly from some of the slides that you've seen. Now, these are the data that you've seen in other forms today showing the prevalence of insufficiency from the NHANES studies. And it's classic. This is done from one seasonal section so that we don't have the interference of season and but you get some latitude. It was all conducted in the south for these. But clearly, if you look across race and you're really looking across skin color here, you see that using a very conservative cutoff of 50 nanomolar, that the prevalence of insufficiency is far greatest in non-Hispanic blacks. And it's in women, the prevalence is up to 80%. These are normal, healthy adults that are 30 to 59 years of age. So there's really an issue with intake. What are they eating? It's not sufficient. Well, what are we eating in the United States? These are brand new data that Dr. Whiting brought with her, and they, for the first time, show what Canadians are eating relative to what we eat in the United States. This is taken from the more recent NHANES 2000-2001 and from the Canadian Community Health Survey. And if you just look across gender and age, you can see that roughly the intake, mean intake is about 5 micrograms. Canadians consuming slightly more, but you get a decrease with age, and the AI is higher here. So few people, only the young, are meeting the AI. So what food sources do we have? This panel was taken from Dr. Hollick's recent New England Journal review, and this is what a lot of physicians are going to refer to as to where is D in our foods, because that's the first thing a patient is going to ask you. There's two different sources, natural sources, and these are largely fish, and not all fish. And we have fortified sources, all shown here. In America and in Canada, the vast majority of the vitamin D that we take, dietary vitamin D that we consume, is from fortified foods. And that's, again, across all ages and gender. And you can see these by the red bars compared to total and what's natural. What about fortification? Well, the two countries practice different fortification regulations. In Canada, the two foods are mandatory, milk and margarine. In the United States, we only have one food that's mandatory to be fortified, and that's milk. All the other ones are optional. You can put it in if you want to, but you can only put it into these foods. A very common misconception is that all the foods that I show here, cheeses, cottage cheeses, creams, butters, etc., because they're dairy, are all either fortified or contain vitamin D. It just isn't so. They don't. I don't know why it's there. This is a chart that just came out. This is a release from the USDA nutrient content of foods. And just to make this short, there's over 7,000 foods in this database. And this is what goes into your computer software when you're calculating how much vitamin D you're consuming. Of the over 7,000 foods, only 6% show a vitamin D content that's greater than zero. So it's extremely difficult to estimate accurate intakes of vitamin D. This slide just shows you another problem that we have with intake estimates is that D is not on the label. And we need to start putting vitamin D on the label. These fish clearly contain vitamin D. It's not on the label. In Canada, the label some. They're better off than we are right now, but they need to advance even further. This is another dilemma. It's really important. This just shows that there's no consistency in the time of the labeling. And this is probably one of the most important slides to show here. This is data that we've taken from the NHANES data and looked at intakes. And clearly one of the problems amongst African Americans is that they do not consume the foods that contain vitamin D, which is fluid milk and ready-to-eat cereals, nor do they consume the same level of dietary supplements. I'll skip this really quick because this just gives you the values of what they're consuming. But this is a very important slide. And this study showed that if you look at those African Americans from the NHANES data that consume dietary supplements, you can see that it does, when you're looking at extremely severe vitamin D deficiency, it does very little to bump up to lower the prevalency. Here, you still have an 8% prevalency of very severe vitamin D deficiency. So, what is my recommendation? I'm going to recommend something that is not that well known, I think, to public health workers, and that is to follow a different guideline. And that is the Dietary Guidelines for Americans that was put out in 2005. And this is another government type of recommendations for how Americans should eat. But for the first time in their history, they took a stand on vitamin D. And they said, you have to read the whole thing to find this, that older people and people with dark skin should be exposed to who are exposed to insufficient sunlight should consume more vitamin D-rich foods and supplements. And if you get really buried into the text, you'll see that they, too, recommend 1,000 international units per day for this specific subpopulation. So if there's
a question. Thank you very, very much. If we could please give all our panelists another hand, I'd appreciate it. We would like to hear from you. If you have any questions, let us know. Right back here. Okay, just speak loudly, please.
Thank you.
So, one, it's true, and the Institute of Medicine did recommend that all adults up to the age of 50 be on 1,000 milligrams of calcium. Adults over the age of 50, 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day. That is very important, independent of the vitamin D. In terms of vitamin D absorption, it turns out we did the study because we were curious about this. And it turns out that vitamin D is better absorbed in skim milk than it is in whole milk. Now, you might think that that's contrary to what you would believe, but it turns out that you don't absorb 100% of your dietary fat, and vitamin D is fat soluble. So the more fat you take in with vitamin D, the more you actually lose because you can't absorb it, because vitamin D is absorbed via the chylomicrons. Also, fiber has no effect on vitamin D absorption. Okay, and so you can take vitamin D as that capsule on an empty stomach, and you can take it without any fat, and it's perfectly bioavailable. And then the final comment is, of course, I think we're hopefully now finally beginning to appreciate after 40 years is that moderation in sun exposure has always provided us with our vitamin D requirement. And as Dr. Calvo showed very nicely, I mean, you can get 20,000 units from one sun exposure in a bathing suit for about 15 to 20 minutes on Cape Cod in June at noontime. So you really have a wonderful capacity to make it. And even though aging decreases that ability, you still have the ability to do it. And so we should really think about this in our guideline proposals.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Yeah, let's go on to questions. We are running out of time. Yes, ma'am.
Syndromes. That's the only way they can get it. My recommendation, as I put in the New England Journal Review, is you go in for 30 to 50% of the time recommended by the manufacturer and cover your face with sunscreen. And this way you can take advantage of the beneficial effect globally and not damage your face, which is really most sun exposed and has the most sun damage. You can go on the internet to Sperti, Sperti.com. It turns out that lamp has been on the market since the 1940s. Parents used to go to the local pharmacy to buy that lamp to expose their children. And we just published in Photochem, Photodermatology, and Photomedicine a report showing that the Sperdi lamp is effective in treating vitamin D deficiency in cystic fibrosis patients. So it is an option for you.
Okay, one last question to the panelists. If one's liver is damaged from alcohol and drug use, can the liver then make the necessary precursors for the vitamin D that we need for our bodies? Can they make the conversion? Dr. Hall?
The simple answer is that the liver has a huge capacity to make 25-hydroxy-D. You have to wipe out almost 90% of your liver. But the problem is that if you have liver insufficiency, you have fat malabsorption. So it takes a huge amount more orally to be able to correct it. They will benefit, by the way, from either a tanning bed and or from sun exposure. But their liver will make 25-hydroxy vitamin D.
Okay, thank you very, very much. And we believe that adequate levels of vitamin D should be as common as hand washing. And so we would like very much for you, hopefully you've been informed, inspired, and incited to action to spread the word about the benefits of adequate levels of vitamin D. So we want to thank you all, and for more information, at the CHPPD booth, you can find more information about vitamin D, also at booth 1060. So we thank you, and Dr. Jesse, thank you so much for all of your help. So thank you all very much, and good sunlight.